I'm Ben, I'm an alcoholic. Okay, so they asked me to do this, and then I was like, they're not going to understand me. But, so they're going to have to be a translator. But anyway, so I will be asking questions that I was supposed to. They gave me questions to ask. They were scared of the questions I was going to give. But I'm going to sneak one in because I got the microphone. But anyway, the first one, and the first one, this one was for Scott, but I'm going to go all the way down the line. But then when it gets to Bill, it's going to skip and go to Steve and then go to Bob. Okay, Scott. Oh, I got it. What was the biggest mistake or the biggest life event you have been through in the last few years, and what did you learn from it?
Are we using these?
Yeah. Scott Lee, alcoholic. Hi, you guys. I would suppose cancer is kind of a big deal. I mean, who knew? But I was diagnosed with cancer in my throat in June of 20. And first thing to do is take my teeth, because they're going to radiate my jaw to the point where my jawbone is now dead. And you can't have teeth in a dead jawbone, they say. I surrendered to them. And they radiated my throat to the point where it's all scar tissue in there now. And I'm on a liquid diet. That's why I keep getting up and going to the bathroom. I had two chocolate Ensures for supper tonight, because I can't swallow anything thicker than applesauce. But what I learned, and it meant the world to me. Would you hold this for me for just a second? What I learned was what my assignment was, and I got it very quickly, and I'm so grateful. My assignment was to cheer up the people that were trying to cheer me up. And what I did was I put a clown nose on my mask. And I've been carrying clown noses for a long time. Because when Interstate 40 comes to a stop in Nashville, what I do is I pull out a clown nose. And I put it on. I need you to hold it in. And then I drop my window. And I blow bubbles out the window. And it gets the attention of the other drivers, and they see the clown nose, and they start laughing, and I start laughing. Because laughter is contagious. And I'm still stuck in traffic, but have found a way to turn it into a more pleasant experience. So I've been doing that for a long time. And so now I carry clown noses. I buy them 100 at a time. I just got another delivery. And I've also got little safety pins. A clown nose won't stick to this mask, so you got to have a safety pin. I'm carrying the safety pins. And if somebody says something nice about it, I offer them one. Some take it, some don't. I give them a safety pin for it. I'm convinced if my will's been on, I will never have a tombstone. But if I were going to have one, I'd want this to be on it. Serving the God of love is not a part-time job. It doesn't matter what's going on with me. My mission continues to be to spread love and joy and look for ways to be of service. And it is those times when I don't feel like doing that that it's the most important that I do it. If I'm sloshing love and joy all over you, it splatters onto me every time. And I needed some splatter over this last couple of years. And I'm at peace. I'm on a liquid diet probably for the rest of my life. So I can look at that, or I can look at the fact that I get to live the rest of my life. Don't feel sorry for me. I've made my choice on that. I'm not going to come into the chow hall and watch you guys eat, but I'm okay with it. And that's been a phenomenal gift. And I think it's a gift from I was taught a long time ago that I can't change me. If I could change me, I would have changed me. And I wouldn't do all the stuff we have to do. But I can change my actions today. And as I do that day after day after day, I become changed. And I've been changed, thank God, into a guy that thanks God. That I'm at peace in my own skin. I tell the new guys, we're not here to change you into anything. You're already everything you've ever needed to be. We're going to help you evolve into who you really are. And that's what's happened with me. And part of that for me is this commitment to try to spread love and joy no matter what's going on with me. Thank you.
Share now.
put the finger up again, Bob. Here you go. Put the lump finger.
How do you follow that, Bill? Alcoholic.
Hey, Bill.
Well, I suppose the biggest thing that's happened to me. 5 years ago, February, I had a liver transplant. And that'll get your attention. The guys were talking about surrender, and they're going to talk about it more, I suppose. There's a series of them. I've been sober for quite a while, and it doesn't seem to stop. I hope it doesn't escalate any more than it has. You know, I thought I was beyond some of it, but evidently not. And that's been a hell of a journey. There's no doubt about it. I almost died. And I shared about this. I was in the hospital one time, and I was so uncomfortable, and I was trying to meditate. And I realized I was trying to change the situation, and I just sort of burst out laughing, you know, because it was... It's about relaxing into whatever is going on. It is a real profound and deep surrender and an acknowledgement of how ultimately powerless I and I believe we are. We just can't control things outside. I have no control over my own body, much less anything else. But another thing happened recently that some of you might be aware of. We had this pandemic thing. And within a week of them shutting everything down, my men stag was on Zoom. The techie dude stepped up and said, "We got this. We can figure this out." And we went on Zoom. And nobody wanted it. You know, I was very concerned, my God, what's going to happen? We've lost our meetings. How are we going to do this? How is this going to work? And there was resistance, and there still is. There's people that just flat won't do Zoom. I mean, they just stand their ground, and they have their individual rights, and they forget evidently about the common welfare and just go about their business and stand their ground. And I considered that for about 30 seconds, and I said, this is what we've got, this is what we've got to do. Now, I've been sober a long time, and I would much rather be a wise man than a bleeding deacon. You know, if I have any kind of influence, hopefully it could be used to bring us together, to help the situation, to try to improve it. And myself, and not just me, but many of us really did that. We got this thing together and we started Zooming and we created a couple more meetings and we just started running with the ball. And lo and behold, it has given the world more access to Alcoholics Anonymous than it has ever had. This has been a net hugely positive event. I mean, some of the meetings you go on, it's like an old folks home. I mean, all these people that are shut up, you know, that are shut in their homes from illness and their age and stuff, I mean, they're rock stars in AA now, man. They can go to 3 to 4 meetings a day and become speakers. You know, and people want to hear them, and they haven't had access like this to AA. And that alone should tell you something. Every month I do workshops in Russia. This guy went before me, and so did this guy. I was over there one time, spoke at a meeting, and I'm signing books. They had me sign their books, and these guys' names are in the book. I came back, and I called them, and I said, "I'm in the book, man." You know, it's like, it's, but now I start doing these Zoom, going through the steps with people, you know, now we're just reading the book together, right? And through a translator. And it's amazing, you know, doing workshops in Tehran. You know, I mean, who knew that that was going to happen?
Who knew that you were going to see this explosion of Alcoholics Anonymous around the world? Now, the men's stag comes back, wants to be hybrid. We had a faction within our group that didn't want the hybrid. We just want to come back to the room the way it was. It needs to return to the way it was because change is deadly, right? So we had a group conscience, right? And the group conscience was that we're going to be a hybrid. We have a 360-degree camera from the techie guys. We got a big screen TV. We got 30 guys on Zoom from South Africa, New Zealand, Australia, different other parts of the U.S., and about 40 to 50 people, or 40 or so, 50 maybe, in the room. And it's amazing. We got back into a circle when we got the 360-degree camera, so we were sitting like the way we sat before. And now we've got these guys that are full-fledged members of the group. We have business meetings. They vote because they're members of the group. I think that's remarkable. It's just amazing. So, yeah, there's been some crises, but out of every crisis, the phoenix rises. Change happens. Life is dynamic. It's not static. I think this is the way it's supposed to be. And hopefully we won't get so stuck in our ways that we don't go along with it rather than resist it and stop it for feelings of insecurity about the change. You know? So that's been fascinating.
Bob Alcoholic. The changes that you describe in your group is fantastic. The two most significant events in the last number of years in my life and my family life was the death of our daughter-in-law in a homeless encampment, died as a meth addict, the mother of our grandchildren. Been the treatment 6 or 7 times. That's private. I don't know why I'm doing that on tape. I guess so used to recovery. And we're just shocked. You know, we keep thinking there's something that we can do. The other was I had open heart surgery a couple of years ago. Two years and 3 months or something like that. Life, I can't believe how old I am. I mean, I go by the mirror. You know, I reach the age where if I have two of anything, one hurts and the other doesn't work. And but the nature of life as you get older is it's a series of deaths. Just a series of death of your athleticism, of your sexuality, of your business career, of your, you know, and that's, I believe, the real design of life. To allow us, you know, that when we do exit, to be more present to what that is, not rather than cling to, you know, I mean, if you want to cling as tightly as serves you in the process. But it is, the pandemic, which has been hard on a lot of us, and business-wise has been somewhat hard on us, has been one of the greatest opportunities I've ever seen for, you know, I'm afraid for the world. I'm afraid for our country. I don't know why I look at it. It just seems more problematic. But the experience that I have had and you have given me over the last 2 years in life is just the sweetest thing in the world. I mean, you know, it is fantastic. I'm just going to keep doing this as long as I can. Thanks.
Hey guys, Steve Alcoholic. You know, I sit here and listen to these guys, and Scott lost his teeth, Bill lost a major organ, Bob had a heart attack. I've had none of those challenges, which I'm very grateful for, but it just, I have no street cred in AA tonight to talk about. It'd be much more impressive to have overcome something significant. But I listen to these guys talking, and I don't just listen to these guys talk, you know, I've known all of these men, a long time. Scott, I knew Scott before either of us got sober. I have a video of Scott with that red nose on drinking a beer on Halloween of, 1982. That's right, and I'll show it at the group picnic if he gives me any trouble here. But But he was talking to kids out around a campfire up in that cul-de-sac where he was my brother's next door neighbor. I've known Bill and Bob a long time. You know, the thing I'm always having to overcome is myself. And it shows up in ways I don't typically anticipate. And it's not always dramatic, and it's not always rising like a phoenix from the ashes of something that's crashed and burned. But maybe the biggest revelation, a couple of them over the last 3-4 years. In February of 2019, I did a fear inventory. And the fear inventory has always been the most revelatory inventory for me. And I did it around some work stuff. I did it around some financial stuff. And really, it wasn't about the work and money. It's about how do I look around the work and the money. And but I was working at a job that had lost its attraction for me. It had changed. I didn't align with it. Didn't make it good or bad, but it wasn't aligning with me. And yet, I'm not a guy who is financially, who has to not make financial considerations sometimes in making choices. I walked in, but I knew that I needed to step away from this and do something else. And I went in, I talked to my wife, and I told Connie, I said, I think I need to step away from this. And she said, as most reasonable people would, I get it, but you can't leave a job till you get a job, all right? Look around. I want to stay here. And I said, you know, I don't think I can look for a job till I leave the job. Now, that might not be true of everybody, but that's how I felt. I said, I don't think I can see clear-eyed until I step back away from this. And the next day she came back out and she said, I'm on board. She said, I get it. So let's do that. And the result of that, or what followed, I don't know if it's a result of that, but what followed was I have had a job that I do feel aligned with, that I enjoy, with people I enjoy working with and working for. But that not just the faith that I'll be okay, but that the buy-in, the partnership that Darren talked about, that's been huge for me. The other thing, and again, I'm a glowing gratitude. As this pandemic hit, and Connie and I live in a little condo, and I will tell you that 1,270 square feet 25 years ago in our marriage would not have been enough room. And for this 2 years, we could not have enjoyed each other's company more. We could not. I recognize the value of that partnership, the gratitude for it. And again, that's not overcoming something, but I think that Bill talked, or I think Steve talked a little while ago about Sandy saying, and they'll talk some more tomorrow, that you're already okay, and you're the one that doesn't know it. And I think what happened is I sit here tonight with a greater awareness than I've ever had, that I'm okay, that it's okay, that you're okay, and that we're okay. And sometimes that gets shaken, but on balance, I have a greater belief and faith and true awareness of that than I've ever had it. And in no small measure is that due to my relationship with men like you here and weekends like this that I'm privileged to be a part of. Thanks.
We're going to stay with you on this next question and come back down this way. Okay, does divine dissatisfaction ever truly leave us?
I just told you I was okay. Now you got me questioning myself. I just don't know what I believe anymore. And I understand that phrase, divine dissatisfaction, but I don't think my dissatisfaction is divine. I think my dissatisfaction is a self-imposed crisis most of the time. And it is that what these guys have talked about, it is that ego-driven, it is me identifying a problem and then realize, and I'm the one that labels my problems a problem, right? I identify something out here and decide it's problematic, and I can't be okay till it is resolved to my satisfaction. And I think the 12 and 12 says this isn't a life of having my demands met. It's a life of lessening my demands. And that's more and more what I've tried to do. I'm gonna tell a quick story because it's my favorite one, so I'll pretend. So I'll pretend that it fit. I'll pretend it fits here. But see, our problems get resolved in ways that we don't anticipate. Right, God solves my problem, but I'm usually working on the wrong thing. There's the sales guy, right? He's the top performer in the company. He is, by all accounts, a wonderful guy. He only has one thing that is just really problematic. Every week when he goes in to give his report to the CEO of the company, he wets his pants. And he's humiliated and embarrassed by that, understandably. And after that happened a couple of times, the CEO is a kind, compassionate, and thoughtful man, and he says, we're going to set you up with the company psychiatrist. He says, great. So he goes. The next week he comes back. He walks in to give his report to the CEO, and he wets his pants. And the CEO goes, man, I'm sorry you weren't able to get in to see the psychiatrist. And he goes, no, I saw him. He went, well, I'm sorry that he wasn't able to help you. And he said, no, he helped me. He said, dude, you just pissed yourself. And he said, yeah, but I'm no longer embarrassed about it. And I think that's where I'm trying to get. Thanks.
Bob Alcoholic. I don't say two things about divine dissatisfaction. The only place that rings a direct bell for me is Dowling's visit to go see Bill Wilson above the 34th Street Club house in Brooklyn. And Bill Wilson lived in 50 different locations in the first 2 years of Alcoholics Anonymous. When we talk about giving up, they talk about him having a big ego, you know. He and Lois slept on couches. What they gave up for our fellowship was just extraordinary. And on a day when Bill was in bed and by his own description depressed, this little Irish priest struggles up the top of the stairs and knocks on the door during a significant rainstorm and calls on Bill Wilson. And they have this chat. And Dowling is the guy that started AA in St. Louis and was considered kind of a real member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He was integral to what happened in St. Louis. But in that conversation, Bill is talking about his depression, and he's talking about, will it ever leave? And I don't know if I'm making this up because I can't think of the source right now. So, yeah, and Dowling says, no, I don't think so. I think it's of God. Excuse me. We would not be getting from you what we're getting without that divine dissatisfaction. Without your lessening of ego and without your being broken open, we would not be the benefactors. So for us to make changes is almost like the ego views is dying. Elizabeth Kubler Ross says the four stages of death and dying, denier, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance are the five stages. Denial is maybe I don't have the cancer. You know, anger is, you know, why the hell is this happening to me? Bargaining is, God, please take this away and I'll do whatever the hell you'd want me to do. And depression, which is circumstantial depression appropriate to the circumstance of what Bill was talking about, the near-death experience. And then in Scott Peck's book, Further Along the Road, Less Traveled, he's talking, but if you allow depression to do its work, which is to grind the ego to dust, you break through to acceptance, to this open place, and everything's okay. But most of us don't go through depression. We go through denial, anger, and bargaining, and we back up and go back and circle back and never get to go through the depression to allow it to do the work that it's intended to do. And there is a holy place for some of the dissatisfaction that we have in our lives. There is a fair amount, you know, I mean, the whole essence of Buddhism, the suffering that is due to attachment, is due to the attachment that we have to having things be the way we are, to have what we want, to not lose what we have, you know, all that sort of thing. And we seem to have this idea that we should not have any difficulty, which is the other first line in Scott Peck's first book. Life is difficult. But there's a lot of us that I think we're being told by the world that if you manage well, it's not difficult. Baloney. No one's exempt. Period. End of story. No one's exempt. So I think there is a role for design, for divine discomfort. Thank you.
Sometimes depression is the appropriate emotional response. Sometimes dissatisfaction is dissatisfaction. I don't like the way things are. For most of my life, I lived my life in such a fashion that evidently, if you watched from the outside, things outside of myself need to be different in order for me to be okay. Because that's how I behave. It's your fault. I don't believe I'm powerless. I lean into stuff and I cause trouble. There's a sense of injustice. There's something wrong with the state of the universe. There's something wrong with things. You can't tell me what to do. And when I got here at 37 years old, and I look back on that, what my problem was, and I believe what most of our problem is that I'm emotionally immature. I drank and used through most of my youth, learning experience, and I got here, and I'm going to grow up now. And I'm dissatisfied. I do not like the way things are. I'm not divinely dissatisfied. I'm just dissatisfied. You know, things aren't right. And the world owes me a living or whatever, all of that immature thing. And what's happened over the years, you ask, does it ever go away? I believe so. I think it does. Doesn't mean that I'm not going to be depressed or I'm not going to be sad or be hurt. But that sense of injustice in the universe, when there is the realization that things are just as they are, I'm powerless. I can't blame you and the institutions and stuff anymore. High school's over. I got to own it now. I'm in the world. I'm not standing outside looking. I'm part of what's going on. Nothing was ever personal in the immature person. Everything's personal. Everything is personal. It's all happening to me. I have no self-awareness. I'm just reacting to things as they happen. I have no idea what my part is or anything because I haven't grown up enough to be able to see the parts that I play. And ultimately, I have bad interpersonal relationships because I have absolutely no compassion and I don't even know that because I don't know what it is. I've never had it. And that will be very dissatisfying. Life does not go well when all of that is working together. And I believe what happens here as we grow up, as we walk this spiritual path, which will develop emotional maturity, I'll realize how powerless I am. And isn't that a good thing? I don't have to run anything anymore. You know, it's just unfolding right in front of me. All I have to do is respond to what's happening. And now I realize it's not your fault, you know. I mean, I had on my first inventory the Department of Motor Vehicles. Who the hell are they to tell me whether I can drive or not? You know? And don't you see that throughout our country and around the world right now? You can't tell me what to do. There's a common welfare, my ass. You know? And it's, we're just not part, we're polarized and all of that. That goes away. You know? Nothing is personal. Nothing, nobody was there. People are just doing what they do and I happen to be in the blast radius of their behavior. And a lot of times you're in the blast radius of my behavior. And I'm not doing it to you. You're just the next victim in line. And self-awareness happens, and self-awareness without humor is depression. Because when I stand there and realize, my God, it's me. It was never you. It's always been me. That's a hard truth. And if we really do this work and we start working with others, we begin to develop the compassion muscle. And then at some point in life, even when you're in a hospital with a liver transplant, you're thinking to yourself, oh, well, this is what's happening right now. This is what's happening. And it makes life real easy. You just show up to the next doctor's appointment, you know, and you accept it. Are you happy about it? Of course not. But struggling against it, what good is that going to do? I watched my father when he was dying. I watched him relax and just slide right into it. And at the end, there was no pain. And I was holding his hand. He was fine. And I hope that's how I can go out. Just smiling.
We'll help you.
Thank you.
Wow. Scott Lee, alcoholic. How are you guys? A couple of things come to mind on that. I have the privilege of talking to new guys on a pretty frequent basis. And I share with them, it seems to me that some people come to recovery because they feel the heat, others because they see the light. I'm a heat type. The heat will bring me here, but it won't keep me here. And I think it's critically important at some point to develop a hunger for the light. And that's the underlying thing that I hear here, is to develop a hunger for the light. And I believed for many, many years that God's will was a good deal. I had one of the big white light experiences. And I don't believe that anymore. I believe it's the best deal there is. It is the absolute best deal there is. That's how good that God is. That's what I believe right now. The problem is I can't remember that all the way to the driveway in the morning. And I get back to being a victim of the delusion that I think if I can get what I want, it'll make me happy. The other thing that this reminds me of is I think the single most difficult assignment I've ever been given is one day at a time. I blew that off when I first thought, yeah, don't drink today. But it also means live only in this day. To bring my mind right here. When we were at the treatment center the other day, graffiti on the restroom wall said, be where your feet are. That's good information to just be here. To not allow anything to rattle around inside my head that doesn't contain the word today. All the good questions contain the word today, and all the good answers contain the word today. And it is so difficult because I have such a history of being off in the past, reliving victories, some of which may have actually happened, or I'm off somewhere in the future trying to figure it all out, and what if they do this and whatever, and all of that stuff, and I miss right here, right now. Which is where the action is. There's one who has all power, that one is God, and you find him now. Isn't when I find God, it's where. My God is a God of right now. It's a problem with fear. Fears are always in the future, and God's not in the future. And I don't need to go where he's not. My time travel machine's a one-seater. And when I hop in that thing and get out of right now, I go all by myself, and I'm in very bad company. So I believe I have three vocabularies, a speaking vocabulary, a praying vocabulary, and a thinking vocabulary. And I try to use the word today as frequently as I can in all three of those. Stop trying to figure it all out. And don't ask any questions, especially in my mind, which is where the biggest problem lies, that don't contain the word today. The question is, what am I going to do about my relationship? It's the wrong question. What am I going to do about it today? What am I going to do about my finances? What am I going to do about them today? That brings me out of that dissatisfaction. Because right here, right now, man, I'll ask you, everybody nod for me. Are you okay right this second? Everybody all right right now? Okay. How about now? How about now?
No.
To get right here, right now. I think that's where the magic is. Yeah, between the claps, can't clap, but between the claps. Yeah, thank you.
Okay. What time do we stop? So we got, yeah. Okay, the next one is going to be, how has your practice of step six evolved since you first did this step?
I don't think mine has. I had, I told the big white light experience while I was in treatment, and I completed, I went through this aftercare plan from this treatment center, and I completed their alleged four step, and I did a fifth step with a counselor, and I got some relief, and I was lying in bed. I'm still unsponsored. I was lying in bed sober 3 or 4 months, and it felt like I was floating in God's love. It felt like it was all around me, and it was supporting me. I've had 2 or 3 experiences like that, and if I could create them, I'd be in it right now, but I can't. And I'm laying there in his presence, so filled with the understanding as best I can of how wonderful this God is and how generous and how much he wants the best for me and knows what it is, and I clearly don't. And I said to him, please give me the hardest training I can possibly stand and make the most out of me that you can. I will tell you, I've had times I wish I had not done that. Because he went all in on that. And some of this training has been pretty tough. And yet, when I'm in my best place, part of my morning prayer is that same thing. Please, give me the hardest training I can stand so you can make the most out of me that you can. And I don't think that's changed for me. When it changes for me, it lessens. But when I can bring myself back to that, to remember who he is, my step six does not change.
I think that, you know, I become willing. I just don't do 7 and humbly ask. It's like, you know, but I'm willing, you know, and, how has that changed? I think one of the aspects, maybe a major aspect of self-awareness is really developing in an enhanced way, the skill of being the watcher, of watching yourself. You know, self-awareness as compared to self-obsession, where I really kind of, on a good day, I can actually watch myself move through life. And meditation really helps enhance that skill, and it is actually a skill that can be learned to do that. What I'm able to do is I really see myself. And so we talk about character defects and shortcomings. What are my character defects? What are the defects of my character? More importantly, what are the aspects of my character that are missing that never developed? And once I work on that and I start developing some compassion where I really begin to care about you, and that expands to other people, people I work with and my home life, and I begin to actually care. Now I wouldn't consciously hurt you. And if I do hurt you, I know how to make amends. This addresses the defects of my character through awareness. And we all would like to be able to, all of us sit and think, I should be different than I am, right? I should be a little more demure, a little quieter, not so out there. I should speak with a lower tone. You know, maybe sit over in the corner and watch other people dance. That is like never going to happen to me. You know, I'm never going to be that shrinking, violent, introverted kind of person. I'm just not like that. So we're going to have to work with what we got here, you know. And the other thing is evidently there's not enough attention in the universe to satisfy me, you know. So I shouldn't be that way so much. I shouldn't be like that. You know, I should be quieter. Let you have a turn once in a while, you know. So I address these things, and this is actually, I've written that down, talked about it, and looked at it, and what I've come to realize is that, for the attention thing, I get plenty of attention. I just do. I get a lot of attention. I get attention from people, and I get attention from my wife, and I get attention. Why do I think I need more than I already get? There you go.
You're a dick.
Oh. He says I'm a dick. Yeah. I just wanted to repeat that so they heard, because he's... You need to be a little more out there. You know? So now what happens, you know, being aware of that, there were times where I would sit and listen to a speaker and it was difficult to hear his words because I was comparing myself to him. Is he better than me? Am I better than him? And I sat there, and that is painful. And now what happens when it's someone else's turn, I dig it, you know, and now it's your turn now because we're sharing this. I'm not the only one in the room. You know, look at Steve's doing pretty well today. Kind of, yesterday was better. Today was, he was a little snotty, don't you think? You know? And, poor Darren had to put up with that. It was awful. And, but, you know, I can see it and I can enjoy it. I can participate and enjoy it. Now that, I think, is addressing a defect of character and having it morph, but it's not about changing myself. It's about accepting myself the way that I am and then adapting to a given situation with some awareness. So in that sense, you know, I think that's maybe how my sixth and seventh step has come along, being able to look at it and say, I really don't want to be that guy. I don't want to be like that. I really don't want to be like that. You know, I want to be able to revel in your success as well as enjoy my own. I don't want to be the one-sided kind of guy. And at time, things have changed.
Thanks, Billy. Bob Alcoholic. Go back and quote that Al-Anon that talked about step 1, 2, and 3 are to give up. 4 and 5 are to own up. 6, 7, 8, and 9 are to clean up. 10, 11, and 12 are to grow up. I never believed, when I look back on it and try to be as honest as I can, I didn't believe step 6 and 7. You know, when you do your first 3 steps and you do an inventory and you go do your, you know, 5th step, you entirely ready to have God remove your defects of character? Oh, hell yeah. Humbly ask him? Okay. And then 5 years later, when you still have a significant list of defects of character and unmanageability, you wonder, what's wrong? Am I either not doing the program? I mean, either the 6th and the 7th step doesn't work, or I'm not a very good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Today, every fiber of my body believes in step 6 and 7. And, as Bill said, I sometimes don't ask. I think Bill's treatise on the 7th step in the 12 and 12 is just one of the great treatises that he's ever written on humility. It just is such a powerful, thing in our lives. It is, we're in our own way. We're in our own way. When, I forget, it must have been Steve talked about, or Daryl was talking about the process of, you know, Master Eckhart talked about the process of finding God, the process of removal, you know, to remove what's in the way. And, so now I'm an old guy, and my life is changing, and I'm getting tired of me, which is good. I really would like to be done with me. I mean, if you ask me what I'd like, and I'm more done with me than I have ever been. Now, I still, it isn't like I don't have an ego, and it isn't like I don't do dick once in a while, but I'm tired of my A talk. I'm tired of listening to myself. I am more able to be attentive to the people in my life today than I ever have been. To my children, who used to be an interference to me, an inconvenience to me. Good Lord. I mean, you know what we're talking about with children. Today, I have less demand. I think I'm able to have the attitude to ask God to remove my defects of character. There's a couple. I mean, I just had open heart surgery, and I'm over smoking a cigar. My wife almost demands that I smoke, so it's kind of a hard thing. You know, I mean, you don't need anything more than a room temperature IQ to figure out you probably should not be, you know, smoking a cigar, you know, after that. But it is.
I brought another one for you.
Thank you. And when you have an enabler, it's just so much easier, you know. But when you talk about partnership, my wife, so I go about 3-4 weeks without having a cigar, and then I go buy 10 of them, and then I have 3 or 4 days where I do. My wife now comes out and says, if you're going to smoke, I'd like to come out and have a glass of wine with you. Now, I know every fiber of her body does not want me smoking that cigar. The kids are asking, is Dad done? Is, you know, so forth. But I believe, and many of us, as we talk about over the course of our life, we still maintain serious defects of character that hurt ourselves and the people around us. We maintain defects of character and behavior that if we don't change them, some of us are going to lose our careers. Some of us are going to go bankrupt. Some of us are going to lose our marriages. And we're still driving the bus headed to the cliff, going 30 miles an hour with no brakes. And 6 and 7 are the linchpins of turning that ship, of being entirely ready to have God remove our defects of character. And He will. It is our consciousness. And what will change that is the impact that we have on each other in the steps. Our consciousness will alter and change, and we will no longer be able to do things that don't work. We just won't be able to do it. I mean, there are things right now in our lives as active members of Alcoholics Anonymous we just can't do. And that's why, because it's an alteration in consciousness. Nothing changes until our consciousness changes. And once that changes, it's a new pair of glasses.
Steve, alcoholic. It is tough to go forth in this group. But because you have you ever been sitting in a meeting or maybe like this, and you hear people share and it challenges your thinking in a good way. And you go, oh. And obviously that's what happens when guys like this are sharing. You know, I think with the great intentions and enthusiasm, treated steps 6 and 7 like behavior modification. And I've identified some stuff I'm doing, and I'm going to try not to do that anymore. And that's not a bad thing, right? The 12 and 12 says that God won't render me white as snow without my cooperation. I think I'm encouraged to act better. But I confuse my character defect with my behavior. And the character defect isn't the behavior, at least in for me, it is the outgrowth of the defect. It's the fruit of the tree. And I'm encouraged to get to the root of my problem, which remains selfishness and self-centeredness. And in the third step, I turned my will and my life over to the care of God, and I meant it to the extent that I understood it, and said, do with me as you will. Then I did a fear inventory, which was a list of things that I obviously didn't trust God with in the third step. Right, if you ever look at that fear inventory, it's just me breaking my covenant with God. Except, you know, do with me as you will, accept these things. And then I get to 6 and 7, I learn about myself, that self-awareness that Bill talked about. I begin to see me in ways that I've never seen me. And the thing is, that continues. 32 years later, it continues. In fact, sometimes it is more stark than it's ever been. And you come face to face with something, and I learn something about me I did not know a moment before. And it is both terribly uncomfortable and disheartening and encouraging and exciting all at the same time. Because now maybe I can find the willingness to put this in the game in a way that I didn't know I hadn't put it in the game. I see the things I think that Bill talked about a little bit and Bob that that I run, I'm that extreme example of self-will run riot, though I usually don't think so. And so I hardly ever hurt anybody on purpose anymore. But I do, you know, some of my greatest damage when I'm properly armed with the facts and have the moral high ground. If I am self-indulgent. So one of the great, I think, bait and switch moments in Alcoholics Anonymous is between step 6 and 7. And I almost hate to let the newcomer in on it. Because I do this inventory, right? And whether it's that fifth step or whether it's something I learned today through this ongoing self-examination that is not self-obsession, but let me take a quick look. Let me see how I'm doing. Let me see where I might be bumping into people. But the sixth step says if I found these things objectionable, and I'm entirely ready to have God remove them. And I go, yeah, here's some stuff. I definitely would like to let this go. And then you lead me into a prayer that says, God, you know, my Creator, I'm now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. Now, whoa, 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 whoa. You know, that's like having a yard sale, right? When Connie and I moved from our home to a condo, that 1,270 square feet, we did an inventory. We went through our house. We identified the things that weren't going to make the move. We identified the things that were old and no longer of value. We identified the things that were cluttering in the way. And we're going to have a yard sale, right? Now you're going to have it on eBay or Etsy. But the sixth step has me pick out all that stuff I'm ready to sell and put it out in the front yard. The seventh step says when they come over to pick through my stuff in the front yard, I say, you know what, go on inside. If there's anything you want to take there, take it too. You know, I'd like to leave the recliner and the TV if at all possible. But see, I don't even know that I'm doing this, and that I don't recognize those things that I'm holding on to. So that idea of entirely ready and take all of me, good and bad, is a doubling down for me of that third step. It has taken that unmanageability in the first step, and now we're not drinking. Now let's get down to some real stuff. I'm willing to be changed. But I'm really saying, do with me as you will again. Take what you need to take and leave me looking like I look. And for a guy that worries about how he looks as much as I worry about how I look, as hard as it is to tell, I literally left the room tonight thinking, not a bad package. At the same time, I'm leaving my house one night, and my daughter goes, you going to wear that shirt? I went, not now. And I've let all of that dictate. And this 6 and 7, in a way, is me going, God, I'm in the game. You know, coach, play me any way you want to play me. And that's tough because I can't get enough attention. I can't get enough attention. But attention is because the ego is insatiable. Self is insatiable. So it's only when that shift is to not be self-satisfied, but to truly be in that God-centered position. And we talked all weekend, for us, those are going to be fleeting moments. I'm going to weave in and out of that. At least that's my experience. And that's why it says that the humility of the sixth step, and my sponsor told me, he says, Steve, this isn't where you're going to get perfect. It's where you're going to come to grips with your imperfection. The spirituality of imperfection, Kurt writes that perhaps the greatest injustice we've done ourselves is the illusion that we're supposed to be perfect. And finding some humility in being exactly who I am right now. Now, one of the descriptions of humility in the fifth step in the 12 and 12 says, I want a clear understanding of who and what I am right now. So that's an accurate picture of this package, coupled with a desire to be what I could be or what God would have me be. So I can be okay right now, but I can't be done. I can't say this is just the way I am. I got to find a way to be okay with this imperfect package here while I stay willing to continue to grow along spiritual lines. And while you guys have talked about second surrender, for me, the point of view that I take about surrender in 6 and 7 is that it is a continuing surrender. It is an ongoing thing that just, there's, the 6 and 7 steps are no more complicated than the first day I read them, but the spiritual depth of them continues to reveal itself to me on an ongoing basis. Thanks.
Okay, we have one more question, got 5 minutes apiece, and you don't like going fourth, right?
I like to go third.
Third, okay. okay, this one is the most profound amends you have done since you've been in recovery. We'll start with you,
Scott. Yeah, wow. I had a sales manager who was a Green Beret who was on the ground in Laos, and he doesn't know how many times he killed with his hands. And he and I were drinking buddies, and we were pretty close. I flew a gunship, and we don't think we ever worked together, but guys flying my airplane saved his bacon a number of times. And he was sleeping with the boss's daughter, and I knew it, and I was drunk one night, said something about it, got back to him, and I lied my way out of it. And I got sober and realized I had to go try to make that right. And it's kind of a big deal. And he came to town. He's in another state. And he came to town. He was at the Opryland Hotel. And I called someone and said, oh, yeah, great. Come on over. I'm in the room. And I'd been told, Wall Street Dan and I don't know where Dan's here somewhere, we talked a whole lot when he was newly sober about if you want God to be real in your life, treat him like he's real. So I did that. And I asked God to go with me. And I held the door for him. I went down to the car and opened the passenger door and moved the junk and asked him to get in. And tried to drive in a manner that did not scare him. And got to the hotel and opened the passenger door and asked him to go with me. I can remember standing outside the door like this, getting ready to knock, knowing that I'm going to tell this man the truth. And if he decides to kill me, I won't even be able to slow him down. I could be dead in the next 2 or 3 minutes. And was able to knock on that door because of what you have done to me, because of what's in that book. I don't hold myself up as a shining example. I do not consider myself to be one. I destroyed my life sober 25 years. No one knows more about that than I do. But that particular day, I was walking in the sunlight of the Spirit. And my wife and I were guests in his home a month later for a week. It was astonishing. And what I learned from that is if you want God to be real in your life, treat him like he's real. Thank you.
I was just sitting here thinking. I got two. I got to pick one. I think. When I got sober, I was married. A woman named Mary. We had two kids. A 4-year-old girl and a 4-month-old boy. And we stayed together. The marriage was really on the rocks, and we hadn't had any sex in a long time, and there wasn't any, looks like there was going to be any either. She was pretty pissed off for a lot of really good reasons, and I was pretty awful. And but we stayed together. We did a little therapy, and we stayed together. She got involved in Al-Anon, got a sponsor, actually worked the steps, and we went down the road, and we raised those kids. And at 9 years sober, right around 9 years sober, I had an affair with an AA woman. And at that time, you know, we're married. We had remodeled our house, and, you know, business was going pretty well. My life was really good. And the kids were in soccer, and everything was, from the outside, looked really good. And some of you have heard me tell my story that back in the day I was the phony biker with the clip-on earring, right? What I realize now, what I became, was the phony AA guru. And I wasn't really conscious of that, but I look at it now coming out the other side, and that's exactly what was going on. I'm sponsoring lots of guys, I'm speaking around a lot, and, you know, I mean, things look really good. And I'm, you know, a businessman, and it looks really good, but behind the scenes, you know, I'm skulking around, and before I hooked up with this woman, I'd been working on it for a while, so I'm living a double life. And I lasted about 2 weeks in this affair, and I just unloaded on my wife and told her what was going on, and I walked out of the house just before Christmas. It was awful. It was really awful. It was cruel. The woman broke up with me. I ended up living in a storeroom over my office, and I was humiliated and hurt. My fall from grace was very public, and there were a lot of people that were really happy to see it happen because I was an arrogant, pompous guy, you know, loud, preachy, and level two sobriety, man. That's when you start teaching it. You don't really have to do the work. You know, you don't have to talk to your sponsor because you're the dude, you know, and I injured people. I was, you know, arrogant and pushy. I'm a bully. And there I was in that storeroom, devastated, ashamed, embarrassed, hurt, angry, all at the same time. I've never experienced emotional pain like that. And it was just awful. It was hard. So fast forward, I didn't run away. You know, I kept going to AA, and I had a lot of amends to make in AA. But there came a time down the road, you know, I eventually met my now wife, Karen. So this was 28, 29 years ago, something like that. It came time to make amends to that wife, Mary. I had to make amends for this. How do you do that? I knew I needed to do it. I might have been pompous and arrogant and a phony guru, but I'd done the work, man. I knew what had to happen here. I knew it was my fault. There was the fourth column in the inventory I did was very rich, you know, because I knew it wasn't you. So I wrote out what I was going to say, and I took it to my sponsor. He edited out the explanations and the, you know, all of this. I stood in that storeroom, and I rehearsed it. I said it out loud, I don't know how many times. And I called her up, and I went over to the house and went upstairs in a bedroom, and I sat down with her. And I made my amends, and I just own it. And it was hard, but it needed to happen. You know, I mean, and she was hurt. She was sad. Some time had gone by, but it was really rough. And she just started crying. I was crying. I'll never forget sitting in that room and holding her. She just came up and I just held her. She's like a sister to me today. She's around all the time, and she's the mother of my children. And some years, there was a time I had a birthday party for me in my backyard, just a small party, you know, and she came over. And she gave me a gift. And it was one of these cheesy little things you get at the Hallmark store, and it's one of those little things you roll down, you hang it on a string, and it said forgiveness. And she said in the note in there, she says, "I figured you really needed this." And I looked at it and went, "Oh, baby, you have no idea." It's like, I just needed some forgiveness, you know. It was hard to do. There's a couple of other really good ones too, but that's a good one.
Bob, alcoholic. Yeah, I got quite a few, but I'm going to talk about my son. Linda and I have three kids. Bill's 53. I know their names, but I don't know their ages. Bill's 53. Peter's 50. Daniel's about 40. And at one time, all three of the kids were in the program. Not so much now, but Peter's very active in AA. Peter was the most like me. He looked like they let the air out of me before I ruined my temple. He's really an interesting kid, but he was the family asshole. I mean, he went to five colleges and, you know. After he was sober about 10 years, he went to, 15 years. He moved to New York, somehow talked his way into the theater school at NYU, or the cinema film school, went out and worked in L.A., ran into a brick wall, decided to reinvent himself, took 20 practice exams for the GMAT, got into Oxford University in England, did a film on the Dalai Lama. The World Economic Forum made him a young global leader, and Harvard gave him a full ride to the Kennedy School, that little dork. And he's an extraordinary man, but he was the most like me, and we were nose to nose. My father was pretty physical with me. And when Peter came along, and he was a real pain in the ass. I mean, he was, there were some arrests, there were car accidents, there were stealing. You know, if I added up the financial issues, they were a couple of $100,000. And I got physically over the top abusive with Peter from time to time. You talk about rage, you know, did that. 20 years sober, you know, 25 years sober. And my internal thought was, if you had my son doing the things he was doing, you'd be doing the same thing. And then sooner or later I got this idea that was a baloney. If my brother was his father, my brother wouldn't do it. And I started to take ownership of the problem, and I started to get counseling, and I started to get help. I took two or three really serious cuts at making amends to Peter. And they didn't stick. And I mean, I, you know, look back on it, and I don't think I was, you know, I don't think there was much missing. But I had this piece of me, I think because there was so much money involved, that I had the right to be critical of Peter. I just had an attitude that, of judgment, and I a resentment, I guess, that I wasn't willing to let go. And when Darren and Steve were eloquently talking about forgiveness, I mean, you have to forgive and you have to forget. And it wasn't until the third time I went to make amends to him. And before I did that, I had to forgive him for every single financial aspect in interaction. He owed me $100,000. I had to let that go. It was in the way. And when I finally let that go, and we have been restored, and the physical thing was gone a long time. But we just loved each other. There was never an absence of love. But it was just bad. It was the Bob and Norb show, my dad and I reversed. And today, it is the sweetest thing in the world. There is nothing in the way. It's done. It is just, and you can just tell, I mean, there's just nothing in the way. And we have been restored to a level of caring and love and intimacy that we had when he was a young child. And I would not have been able to take as full responsibility without you men, without the steps, without the example. You just sit in rooms, and little by little you hear someone talk, and you just know you have to do something about it. I mean, you don't, you know, it's just, you can no longer, you just got me well enough that I was no longer able to be with what was not okay. Thank you.
Steve, alcoholic. You know, there have been a lot of amends like everyone, some dramatic. I had to make amends about infidelities in my marriage. I had to make some significant financial amends, and they make good stories. But the word used when Ben asked the question was impactful. And what's been most impactful to me was fairly recent. You know, it says that in trying to identify these harms we may have done, it's spiritual, mental, physical, and emotional are some areas that we might consider. And I had never considered the spiritual, mental, and emotional harm that I might have done. Joe and I were at, I've seen a couple of Man Up retreat shirts here. Joe and I were at that Man Up retreat in New York 3 or 4 years ago, 2018 or 2019. And I was talking about the eighth and ninth step. We were on that, and as I was talking, I realized that I was actually talking about something, you know, how I had treated my wife in a way that I had never recognized. That, you know, that my sponsor, Don in Louisville, talks about the difference in information and realization. And I understood intellectually and academically some things I'd done, but that day, it became a realization. It became real to me. It was not here, it was here. And some people here know my wife. And she is a live out loud, confident, effervescent personality. But for years, I beat her down. Not to beat her down, but to protect myself. So the term we use these days is gaslighting. I gaslit her for years. I would make her not trust her instincts. I would tell her what she couldn't talk about with whoever we were going to dinner. I would talk to her about what I wish she hadn't said when we got home. I would use her as the butt of my jokes when we were out with other people. And not because, in no way was I intending to disrespect her. It was the height of my own self-centeredness. And again, it wasn't malicious. It was a lack of thoughtfulness, compassion, understanding. But, and we had talked about that before, but I came home that Sunday afternoon. I got home from New York. She was back in our bedroom, and I walked back there, and I said, I need to talk to you. I said, I shared some of the things that had come to me, and I'm telling you, I said, I understand. I said, I did this, and I understand it in a way I've never understood it. And I'm telling you, the eyes that look back at me were different. And, you know, I was sharing a few minutes ago about that 2 years we spent, especially 2020, without ever even stepping out the door hard. You know, we're all wearing hazmat suits or something. But those things, this relationships build incrementally. You start them and they either build or they fall apart incrementally. And man, this was one more building block. And I'm telling you, when I saw that when she saw that I got it, not that I had the information and I'm sorry, but that I'm sorry. I know what I did. I know how it felt. And that was the most impactful to me. And I think that it is perhaps the most impactful for her as well. So that's my experience.
So, give everybody a hand.